greatest feeling of satisfaction and significance of anything that I've done has been raising our kids. But it is a challenge, especially in a fallen world like this one. And we do need to get into that and talk about it. A lot of questions on this. And I hope that we can really go after it. Now, we'll get into the content for tonight. In the music room at 9 o'clock, we'll meet in the music room at 9 o'clock. Just, you know, whoever wants to, it's not a compulsory appearance or anything like that, but anyone who has questions that they'd like to ask. And I've been picking questions off the board there, and you're asking some terrific questions. And it'd be fun to interact on them. Some of them I'll try to answer, tuck them into what I have to say up here. And some of them probably won't get to, and we'll have to answer them after hours or personally or something like that. But the thing that I picked up mainly out of these pages that you put together today, I see tension. I see a lot of tension. It was mentioned, the tension, the time tension. Things I noted down is the tension between being together and being scattered. We need one another. We need to be together, but then we need to be scattered. And what do we do with that? Another tension was doing what we see the Bible says we're supposed to do in relationship to the lost, and then getting along with the leaders in our churches who may have a different feeling about how we should spend our time. And so there's a tension between expectations that are really in conflict, and that's a real tension. And then the tension of family and ministry. And then there are a lot of questions about, well, what is church? And A couple spots that ask about, well, what is parachurch and what is church? I may not get into that. I have written on it in Church Without Walls. In fact, I go after the whole idea of local church and parachurch and take the position that both of them are kind of aberrations within ecclesiology or within the doctrine of the church. So if you want to find out what I mean by that, well, you can have to read that chapter. But then, another thing that I think I pick up and I want to clarify is that we can get into the trap of thinking that if we can just find the right form for the church, then everything's going to be okay. But there is no such thing. There's no such thing as a perfect church form. In fact, there's going to have to be many forms if we're going to reach all kinds. Because any form that we come up with is going to be bound to a certain group of people. And so we need to get our thinking off of how is it supposed to look? That's the wrong question to be asking. You're not supposed to be asking how is it supposed to look. What we need to be doing is we need to be going back to this book and ask the question, what are we supposed to do? And if we don't do that, then we're going to be controlled by people's opinion on how it's supposed to look. But there are certain functions that are essential to God's people, things that God expects us to do. Now, if God expects us to do them, then that ends the discussion on whether we should do them or not. And what we have to set to then is to figure out what? How to do them. And so I know that at this point it can be very frustrating, very disruptive. You can think, well, if we were throwing everything out. No, I think that we need to put everything up for review, and we need to be asking, what is this doing? Is it actually fulfilling a biblical function or not? And then we need to put these things on trial for their lives, and then discover those things that aren't being done at all, or those things that are being done poorly or ineffectively. And then we need to ask, okay, how do we make those things happen? And the thing that I'm talking about here these days is this other half of the church's commitment. The first commitment, let's say, is the edification of the saved, caring for one another, keeping one another. The Bible and the New Testament talks about one another over 200 times. And just in almost every paragraph, you've got this emphasis on needing one another in one way or another. That's kind of redundant, wasn't it? But the point is that we can't even obey most of the Bible without one another. Because it's in my serving you that I can fulfill the things that God tells me to do. If I didn't have you, I couldn't even obey God. So we do need one another. So there's that half. But what about the lost? And we need to see what the Bible has to say about the lost. And what I've said to this point is that the church is in the world for the sake of the lost. And we need to be sure then that our cutting edge is in the world among the lost. And I would suggest that we really don't have a cutting edge. Where is the cutting edge in the church? We really don't have it. Why not? Because this guy is really not in business. We haven't really taken his needs seriously. We have not set out to equip this person as he needs to be equipped. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11, it talks about, that's kind of the cornerstone verse as to what the church is all about. It says that he gave some to be some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, some to be pastors and teachers, and their function is to prepare God's people for works of service. And so they're to serve, and if it's an evangelist, he's thinking about works of service among the lost, some would be among the saved, and so that the body of Christ might be built up until we all reach unity in faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature. And so unless there is this emphasis on equipping the person who is an insider, then there is not going to be a cutting edge in the body. It's as simple as that. And so we're focusing this week on what is that cutting edge like, how do we keep it sharp, and how do we sharpen it up. And at this point, I'd like to just kind of change directions a little bit, and let's say we're setting out to do it now. We've talked about it. I like what you've said, Dana, that we know what to do. It's just a matter of getting off our duff and going out and doing it. And so that's where we're headed here tonight and tomorrow, and we'll walk ourselves through a procedure, a process. And I always hesitate when I do something like this because I don't want a particular process to sound normative, like this is the way to do it, and it's the only way to do it. Remember, we need to talk about functions and not just methods or forms. But I think one of the things that comes out of these pages that is so obvious is that we can't do it alone. We just cannot do it alone. In fact, what you see as we expand on these things is that it really, we're talking about the full spectrum of God's workings. And it's going to take the whole body of Christ to make a lot of these things happen. It's going to take a body of believers providing backing for the things that we're talking about. And so one of the needs, one of the tracks that we have to run on here is community. Another thing that surfaced in our discussion is that there are certain skills we have to have. We have some, we don't have others. Some feel secure, some feel insecure. And so we'll call that competence. And so we need to develop our competence in certain things. Competence in our understanding of the scriptures and competence in knowing how to do certain things if we're going to be effective as insiders. And then the third track that we need to keep in mind is what we are. Our character. Character is what you are when nobody's looking. It's what we do in the dark. And that's your character. Now, community is something that you can put together quite quickly. Competence, the skills that you need to do what we're talking about, It'll take a few months. A grasp of the Bible, that would be adequate, a couple of years. Character will take you the rest of your life. And if you wait until your character is perfect, you're never going to do it. I was talking to someone just before we started here, and we were talking about, you know, the problem of being weak. And you have to wait until you get strong before you can minister to people. Well, no. What is character? It's not perfection. Character has a lot to do with integrity. And I have a friend who, his life, he has some really serious problems that he's struggling with. But he has gone public with his problems. He doesn't go around as if every day with Jesus is sweeter than the day before, because it isn't for him, and it isn't for you and me either, is it? But we play the game. And when we play the game, people can't relate to us. And he just decided that, hey, I'm going to let people know where I'm struggling, where I'm hurting, what I'm dealing with. And so really, you know what he set aside? He set aside his hypocrisy. That's all he set aside. And now, when he's with people, they really can respond to him. They can really relate to him. He talks about battles that he lost 2 days before. And he talks about the things that he's struggling with right now. And people say, oh, I'm struggling with that too. That's character that he's got. And so character is not something that we have to wait a lifetime to acquire so that we can eventually be perfect enough to minister. It's just admitting what we really are. Now, tonight I'd like to speak about this first one, community. Because I think that for us as Americans, this is one of them that is the toughest to get a hold of. One of the deepest characteristics of the American culture is our individualism. You know, our heroes are J.P. Morgan, Wyatt Earp, Frank Sinatra, who popularized the national anthem, I Did It My Way. And so we are our heroes, are people who, with their own two hands and with their wits and just their courage, managed to build empires and win wars and found the nation and earn fortunes. And it's just built into our minds. We're competitors, especially the men in America. We're competitors. We don't have any friends. We just have competitors. And we started out Little League Baseball when we were 6 years old. We weren't playing for fun. And when you were playing to win, and you got it from your dad when you got home if you struck out twice. And so we started competing, and then we're in school, we're in college, we're competing. You compete in the job market. And so you're not a friend to your competitor, are you? And so we are really people that live in isolation because of our understanding, just the competitiveness that has been bred into us. And the bad news for you individualists is that you can't do this one alone. This is one that is not going to yield to your individualism, because God's against you, man's against you, and human nature's against you if you try to do this one alone. And so what we're going to talk about is what it really means to work with others in accomplishing this thing that we're talking about. Three words. Congregation. Group, team. Now, this might clear up some of the confusion that's been rattling around here in the last 24 hours. All of these are right. All of these are necessary. All of these are limited. All of them have a particular strength. What's a congregation good at?
Congregating.
Okay, congregating, yeah.
Identity.
Identity. Okay? What else? Worship? What else? Yeah? Okay, what else?
Provide programs.
Provide programs?
Basically, superficial relationships.
Okay, but I'm asking what they're good at. I guess you're, that's fair. Okay.
If you number a congregation at approximately 100 to 125, you're not going to have a close relationship with 125 people.
Yeah.
There's going to be a limitation.
Okay.
But it's a gathering place where people do get to know each other, at least in the initial of relationships. It may be even or may not.
Yeah. Okay, that's the limitation, which is important to bring out, is that it comes a place where a congregation can't do certain things. Yeah.
It brings together all different types of people who otherwise would not want to associate with each other if they had their brothers.
Okay. Yeah. All right. What else is the congregation good for? Yes.
To gather together as a body to praise God.
Okay. To praise, to worship, someone said. What else? Okay. All right. What else? All right. Yeah, there's the kind of resource power in congregation. All right. What about a small group? What's a small group good at?
Fellowship.
I didn't hear that. Intimacy. All right.
Accountability.
Brainstorming,
prayer support,
encouragement,
identifying and developing gifts.
All right.
Real relationships.
Okay. So that says. All right.
Encouragement, caring, comforting.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's where you can really study the Bible. Prayer.
Safe place to be vulnerable.
Okay, so it's a place where you can unload, tell the truth.
Crisis intervention.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we see that a congregation can do things that a small group cannot, and a small group can do things that a congregation cannot. Now, what about a team?
Projects.
Projects. Okay, that's good.
Accomplishing a mission.
Okay. More mobile, can get around. All right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, you've got it. I think the thing that's important is to understand that any one form is not adequate for what we're talking about. And so it takes different forms for different things. And we need to understand that. One of the confusions that we make is the difference between a small group and a team. We try to make a small group work as a team, and it doesn't work. Or we try to get a congregation to work as a small group. And we're spitting into the wind. It's not going to work. And so we need to understand what they can offer and what they can't offer, and make sure that those things are present. And the point is that the people of God, the work of the body, has to be multiform in its expression. We need various manifestations. And often what happens is that some of these are attributed to this, in quotes, local church, or in quotes, parachurch. I think that that's a distinction that really does damage, because we assign certain things in certain directions, and really what we've done is we've misunderstood the very nature of what the body of Christ really is. So we're going to talk about teaming up, because that's the part where we really begin to see the cutting edge of our ministry. There are four reasons why we need to team up. And I think whoever it was that said it, the team exists for a task, for a purpose. And a small group really exists for support, for helping people work their way through things, for transformation, personal transformation, encouragement. A lot of things happen in a small group that can't happen anyplace else, but a small group cannot be a team. Now, I think a small group is a good place from which to launch a team. See, where does a team get started? Well, you could launch out of a congregation, but it's probably more likely that you launch out of a small group, because it's in the small group where you begin to talk about the kinds of things that need to happen when it comes to reaching the lost. Not long ago, I was in a church that the people that started it and the people that are leading it now and so on, they're good friends of mine, and I've watched it from the beginning, and they wanted me to come and talk about some of these things. And they struggle with this problem of the migratory flock that I write about, where you know you get something going and it's attractive, and so all of a sudden you have you're starting out, you got 100 people, and then you got 200 people, and then you got 1,000, and then you got 2,000, and then you think, oh man, we've got to build where we're going to get $8 million, and so off you go. See, now that's not growth. That's just swelling. And what happens then is the church is really occupied with caring for the needs of people who are not a community at all. They're an audience. And so they don't really have a whole lot of commitment to that particular body. They'll be there as long as the program is good and it meets their criteria, the things that they're interested in. But there's really not a whole lot of permanence to a group of people like that. Yes?
Are they Christians that are swelling? In the church that we attend, the phenomenon is that we are attracting new Christians or Christians from mainline denominations that don't get fulfilled at the Presbyterian or Episcopal Church.
Mm-hmm.
They come to the Bible Church.
Yes.
Not internal growth, but creating, bringing people to Christ within the body.
Yes. That's a part of it. And it's not something that you can just sit and criticize and say, hey, that shouldn't be. That's just the way it is. That's what's happening. And there's no way to avoid it. But I think that what we need to realize is that if that's what's happening in our society, where there's a migration of Christians to certain bodies that where they, they're attracted to it and so on, then we need to recognize the limitations that that imposes on that particular body. They're not going to get out their front door to go to the lost because they're going to be so busy with the people who have flocked in and have chronic spiritual problems that they've carried for years.
I guess the second question I have, I don't know whether people here are of like situations, but the church that we attend is growing quickly and they're flock groups, so we minister to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we want to reach the lost, we go downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Or we go to Mexico or somewhere else and do a week's worth of medical work, but we don't look next door because the people we're taking next door, take care of next door, are the believers. And we really don't have time for the non-believers.
Yes.
Is that a phenomenon that you see within the church generally?
Yes. I think that small groups are kind of in. People understand small groups, and they understand that a small group can help a person grow in a way that they wouldn't someplace else. But then when it comes to evangelism, that's usually what we do. We'll go to the prisons, or we'll go to the, we'll go to Mexico, or we'll go someplace else, and we'll go to people we've never laid eyes on before in our lives and never will again. And we pass up that beautiful network that God has been a lifetime in the making in our own personal lives. We miss that.
But there's not room within. I was asked to lead a flock, and
yes.
I declined, and I said, my heart is really for the unchurched, my next door neighbor.
Yes.
And they said, well, that's great, but at this time in our church, we don't really have room for that.
And I think that that's probably accurate. They do not have the energy to do that because of the influx of people who have true needs that need to be met. It's one of the dilemmas of our time. But if a church like this cannot do that, that does not justify our leaving it undone, does it? No, nor according to this book. And so we recognize those limitations and we say, now there is this task that needs to be done, and we're going to have to find out how to do that one way or another. And so I would say that where your church then is having a difficulty is just because of the influx, taking care of the people that flow in. And the thing that can happen there is it can give you the illusion that you're knocking them dead, that you're reaching the world. But you're not. See, you're just taking care of a certain migration. And the mainstream of America that we talked about yesterday goes totally unscathed. So we have over 50 organizations, Christian organizations, here in Colorado Springs, and we have a number of very good churches. But you know something? The guy in the neighborhood is still safe. And that's a tragedy. We sure are. We're missing a vision. Go ahead. Yes.
And so, I don't think we can do this. No. Excuse me.
Okay, that's what we'll talk about tonight. That's exactly where we're headed. And I would stand by that statement. I think that that's something that we just have to make some choices. See? Now, the small group, I'll go back and pick up on where the small group fits here. The small group can help you a lot in moving into a team situation because you can share what's on your heart with the small group. You can get the small group praying for the 10 most wanted. Get everybody in the group praying for the 10 most wanted. You know, make a list of the people that you want to see come to Christ. The 10 most wanted. Identify them. You know, most Christians can't even come up with 10. They don't have 10 non-Christian friends. So, if you ask them to just write down the 10 most wanted, that's a start. That gets the wheels turning. And they begin to realize that they maybe only have 3 or 4 names. And so then they get busy. But then as you begin to pray together for those 10 most wanted in a small group, what happens is you begin to think, you begin to have a vision for the lost. Then there'll come a time where you need to launch out. And in Church Without Walls, I talk about small boats. In this church that I was in down in I almost told you where it was, but in this church that I was in, they have these small groups. And their idea was, well, we'll just get the Christians to come to our small groups, because the church was kind of divided up into small groups. But that is not going to work, because a small group of Christians already has an ethos, already has a culture of its own, and they already have a history. And a non-Christian comes in and feels like a what? Yeah. And so when you reach out to non-Christians, the first thing you've got to realize is you've got to create something new just for those people. That's the first thing. You have to create something new just for those people. And I would encourage you to think in terms of generating just a small group of unbelievers and begin to study with a few. And so here you are, let's say in a small group, a dozen couples. And you've been praying for the 10 most wanted. You've been sharing with the group your concern for these people that you know and so on. And then you begin to talk to the small group about, well, The Johnsons and us have been talking about it, and what we want to do is we want to go and work with some of these people that we've been praying for. The small group understands it, they endorse you, and they commission you to go do that. Now, you can't just add on activities and survive to tell about it. So when you take something on, you got to leave something go. Huh, dear? And so I learned that from her. This is what she tells me. And so when you take something on, you got to leave something go. And so when that small group is meeting, what are you doing? You're with those unbelievers. And so the small group is kind of the launch pad from which you move out and go to the people that you have been praying for. Now, when you get with a team, then you have made a commitment to action. And so the first thing that you want to do, as you put your team together, is sit down and plan. Say, okay, now, what is it we want to do? Okay, we want to reach these neighbors. Okay, let's pray for them. Okay, when are we going to get started? And so you decide on a time. Now, the next step is to get around to these friends. And I usually operate with neighbors or with just social friends and stuff. And when I'm getting ready to start a new Bible study, I'll begin to talk it up with these non-Christian friends ahead of time. So I'm sure going to let you know about it, and because I really want you to be a part of it. And then just drop it and move on. Well, the person, this neighbor that I'm talking to, his first reaction is, a Bible study with those guys? Man, no way. That's his first reaction. Give him time, because you know the process. First reaction is rejection. Next one is tolerance. Then acceptance, and then embracing. And so you just let it go around a few times. And maybe a couple months later, you see this person again, and you say, hey, we're still thinking about this Bible study. The idea isn't dead. It's just that we haven't had a chance to get started with it yet. But don't worry about it. We'll let you know when we start. Well, pretty soon, he's wondering when you're going to get on with it. And we've gotten into a situation in our neighborhood where I just thank God for garage door openers, because I can sneak in without the neighbors coming over and say, when are you going to get started with this thing? And so you just let people know what you're doing ahead of time, and then set a time and get started. I think the first thing that you need to have when you start with a small group of non-Christians is make them understand right away that every person is a player, even the non-believers. And so our explanation is always, well, we like to get together with friends, like to talk about life issues, use the Bible as our text, and so we just want to keep it small, few friends, just to help one another live through life. Life is a precarious occupation these days, and this is going to help. And so people, they come on board. They say, we like that. But people have got to feel that they're carrying their weight right at the start, even though they're not believers. And there's a lot of things to do to make a small group work, or an evangelistic group work. Someone has to coordinate, get on the phone and say, hey, it's going to be on Tuesday nights over at Carmen's house. The people that have friendships, relationships. Well, I know this person over here who would be interested, and so on. And then there needs to be someone who can teach. Now, teaching here, I mean, that's a low performance type of teaching. It's, okay, let's turn to the chapter. Let's read the first paragraph. Okay, what do you see here? And it's not someone expounding or holding forth. It's just kind of keeping the discussion going, and if you don't understand something, don't worry about it. Now, I would say that the person who teaches should take some time, spend some hours, get a good grasp of the chapter. But you don't do that for the sake of expounding all that you know about the chapter. It's just to make sure that people are picking up the key ideas in the chapter so that they can bring those truths into focus. Hospitality, have it in a different house each time. And then to pray. We have a couple studies here in town, and there's this one gal, brand new Christian, and they were sharing prayer requests the week before. And it was the first time she'd ever really heard about you know, praying for something. And there's this other gal, she had a son from another marriage that was really going through something, and so she kind of unloaded there in the group. And so she just shared with the group what she was going through. Well, this new Christian was so struck by the situation that she spent all night praying for this kid. The next day, found out that this kid's life was turned around. Well, built up this new Christian's faith in an incredible way, and ours too. Yes. Yes. I prefer to go directly to the Bible, and I prefer to stay away from books about the Bible. Bible study books are okay, you know, where you go to passages. The problem is where people, they've never held a Bible in their hands, they don't know the way around. And to have them look up different passages will drive them up the wall. And so we'll use, like in one group that we've got right now, we're in the book of Romans, another one we're in the book of John. And we just take it a chapter at a time. And we just work through it, and that's the way we do it. But what I'm saying here is that you want to create an environment where everybody, the non-believer and the believer, is a participant and feels that they're not just the object of something, but they're participating in something that is going to help them with their lives. And then, of course, gradually they understand the gospel. Gradually they understand grace, and they're going to be born one of those days, and you're going to know it because they're going to be different. And you will know by the difference that appears in their lives. And so one of the things that I've found in this stage with a group of people is we've got 8 people up there, and, you know, I think that's about max in size for a group that is investigating the Scriptures. One of the greatest difficulties is to keep it at 8. Because people hear about it. You know, non-Christians and Christians. And they hear about it, and you know what happens? They want in. And we're so prone to like things that are big and sensational that our first response is, boy, all these people that want to get into our Bible study, isn't that fantastic? We've really got a great Bible study. And so pretty soon you go from 8 to 18, and then you're up to 90. I was visiting a friend of mine up in Minneapolis, and he had a Bible study going in his house, and it grew up to 90 people. And so he had me over one afternoon, and he's a medical doctor, very busy, but he has a big house, and they were all excited about this Bible study. And I says, well, Bill, how long are you going to be able to keep this going? And he looked at me, and I says, you know, the next step, I mean, 90 people in your living room every Sunday night, how long are you going to be able to, I mean, that leaves the house in a wreck. Those of you who had Bible studies in your home, you know how it is after when everybody leaves? It's like an explosion took place in the house. And so you spend the next hour, you're dead tired, you spend the next hour putting everything in order and getting everything clean and everything else. And so here's this couple that had 90 people every Sunday night. I says, the next thing you're going to do, Bill, is you're going to buy a piece of land. And then you're going to have to raise $8 million. Now, is that what you want? And he looked at me and he kind of stunned. And but that's the tendency. So we got this little Bible study in our neighborhood. And there are 2 couples that heard about it and said, oh, we want in. And the gal that had mentioned it to the neighbors was all excited about it. You know, we have these friends. I said, look, let's hold right now because, you know, we've got some things to settle here. And the problem is that as these people come to Christ, they really have some things to work through. I mean, they have some horrendous things to work through. And when you bring someone new in, what happens? We're back to zero when it comes to intimacy. And so then, and then you go from 8 to 10. You can still have pretty good discussion. Get up to a dozen. Your chance to talk diminishes. Get up to 16. And the Bible study becomes a lecture. And nobody has a chance to work their way through their own personal issues. And people are not helped because of our obsession for size. Yeah.
Within that group of 8 that you mentioned, are you saying that there should be a minimum of at least 2 Christians or 2 couples? I mean, I'm not saying dogmatically.
Yeah,
what
do you suggest? Well, I don't think it matters. I think that if you as a couple can handle it, then, you know, that's fine. Or, you know, singles, you know, a couple of Christians and then the rest non-Christians, that's fine. We've done that a lot. But I think 2 couples, with my travel schedule and things, what I do is I try to have someone along who is about to become a watering hole on his own. You know, like Jesus in John, or Luke 7, or John, what is it? 7:18, where he stood up and he said, it's John. He said, you know, he that comes to me will never thirst, and out of him will flow rivers of living water. And so what we want is people not only to get their thirst quenched, but become a river for other people. And so I try to have other people along who can be a river when I'm gone, okay? And so that allows me to travel and keep a personal ministry going. Yes?
So the other question I have is, it's been emphasized that you don't want to take a new believer out of their relational context.
That's right.
And so there's a possibility that like a whole family of like 5 could come to Christ.
Yes.
And one in the study does.
Yes.
Are you going to talk about how do we care for that domino effect if it does happen?
Yes, and it does happen. So we'll talk about that. Okay? Yes?
How long do you stay with somebody?
Let's see. Let's sharpen the question. A non-Christian or a Christian? Non-Christian. It varies. I studied with one non-Christian for 4 years before he came to Christ. There are others that I'll drop off from a lot quicker than that. I think what it takes is a discernment as to whether the Spirit of God is still working with this person or whether the guy has turned in his final vote and said no. So as long as there are signs of struggle, if he's fighting with you, that's a great sign. And so as long as there's a sign of struggle, then, you know, we're still making progress. Yes? Well, okay. I think that what happens here's what happens right here. You've got your 8. And let's say, you know, here's a neighbor. I jogged maybe 800 miles with him before he came to Christ. And then, so he and I have kind of teamed up. And then there are these other people who really kind of, Marge and her neighbor, they walked, I don't know how far, but there was just a relationship going. But then what happens is the friends and contacts of these people, the first generations are slow. From then, you're hitchhiking on the rapport that they have with their friends, and it comes very, very quickly. In fact, we have one study in town where I never laid eyes on these two couples until we sat down to study Romans chapter 1. But these two men were buddies of 25 years with this other guy that I'm with who's supposed to be coming a watering hole, okay? Does that make sense? You had your hand up over here. Yes. Okay. Uh-huh. All right, well, you're asking the question, I'm setting out the answer. Because when you start out and people are not believers, what do they have to understand? They have to answer two questions. Who is Jesus? Okay, get that one settled. And then they have to answer the second question, which is, you know, if they decided Jesus is who he said he was, then they have to answer the second question, which is, what does he want of me? All right? And when they discover what he wants of them and they respond to that, that's conversion. What does a Christian need? He has two questions he needs to answer if he's really going to grow. First one is, who is Jesus? And the second one is, what does he want of me? And so we just go on to the next chapter. But the focus, the focal point of it changes from understanding grace to understanding how to grow in grace. And so it's just the questions change. And we begin to pray for each other. And what I've found is that you know, in small groups, the intimacy can get rather bizarre sometimes. It can get sick. But and I think, you know, those of you who work in small groups know what I'm talking about. It sometimes it just kind of gets out of hand. But the quickest way that I know to get people to really begin to open up is say, okay, what should we be praying for each other? And then begin to share something that I'm dealing with that's a real need. And the person will respond with something. And their first response is going to be kind of a test balloon to see what you're going to do with it. Now, we need to really be faithful with that request. We need to go to God for that request, and we need to get an answer from God for that request. So that person understands what? That God answers prayer, and that you are faithful to that person as a friend. You're giving them the gift of your prayer for them. And so we've gone through, you know, all kinds of adventures with all kinds of people. And the terrific part of it is that you share in the trials of the people that are in these groups. And you also share in the blessings of the victory. Just Saturday night, we had a celebration over in our house because one of these neighbors has been out of work for 8 months and has been looking for a job. And he just bought himself a job or bought a business. And so we had a celebration Saturday night, but we all participated in that because we prayed him through that step by step. So what I'm saying is, as we are in the scriptures, and you can't have a group, people are not going to grow without the scriptures, because that is the truth, that is the light we come to, and then is that we relate to one another, care for one another, and pray, then those people are going to grow. And as they grow, there are these people looking in. And they're going to say, hey, when is it our turn? Just be patient. We'll get to you. And there comes a point where if we continue as eight, it begins to deteriorate. There comes a point where we need to do something. Or we're just going to become a little huddle. And so there is a life cycle for these groups. And I've put it all on one transparency here. And we'll see if this makes sense to you. The life cycle of your team, or keeping your edge, keeping the cutting edge among the lost. The first one you've seen, evangelism, where everybody participates and just they bring what they can to the party. And at first, all they're bringing is maybe the donuts, or maybe they bring the coffee, or maybe we have it at their house. Then they begin to pray for each other. And then someone takes it on. He says, okay, I'll lead it next time. And so pretty soon these people are all actively involved. People begin to want in. And we begin to cultivate the interest of those people. They're a mix. Some of them are Christians. Some are non-Christians. One of the things that I've found is that it's very difficult to keep something like this focused toward the lost. Because a lot of Christians want in to something like this. It's what they're looking for. Now, we can't just write them off. We say, well, we're into something right now. When we finish it, well, then we'll let you know. and you can join us. And so then the next phase is to establish and equip these people that have come to Christ and bring these other people who want in, you know, the people especially who are Christians. And what I've got here is a Bible. You establish them in the Scriptures. I've got a TV set here. The basic idea is, well, living proof is one tool that will help people orient themselves around evangelism. And so when you bring new people in, you want to orient them toward the lost in one way or another. Otherwise, it just becomes another small group of Christians. And so then there comes a point where after you've established and equipped, you need to divide. And here you are, a couple of sets of sixes and eights or whatever. And so again, you have a mix of non-believers and believers. And so we grow by dividing. And so that's basically the life cycle of what we're talking about. And it has to continue to move. It has to be dynamic if it's going to continue to be relevant, if it's going to continue to meet the needs of people. Yes? Go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
Well, like when you divide in phase four, you've been together for 2 years or whatever, and then you say, okay, we're going to split.
Mm-hmm.
The happy ones are still with you, but maybe what about the others that can't be in that same? How do you deal with that?
Well, nobody likes to split because this gets good. And everybody enjoys this, and we enjoy this. And people come in, and this is fun. But what I think we need to do is make it clear that there are just an awful lot of lost people. And it's a luxury that we cannot afford to just indulge in being with one another when there's a lost world. And people understand that, and they'll go with that. Yeah. And Scott, you're going to ask them.
Yeah, I didn't know if you're going to pick up on this later. To me, the next major problem arises is, what are these things? Do people go to church? And if they are in these groups, how much of their needs can be met? Because, for example, I think where we are in Canada, our feeling is we need to create sustainable fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
We have to provide holistic environments because maybe a lot of these new people emerging will not integrate into established churches. So as this, you know, quote, church without walls is going on outside the church with walls, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
What is that in their minds? So, for example, the people in those groups, do they have roots in those groups? And I think a lady had mentioned this question just a minute ago. Is that their church? Does this group continue to go on forever? Where do their congregational quote needs be met, like large group worship, things like that? That's the issue.
Okay. Well, there are, you want to address that?
Yeah.
Yes.
I took my small group to my church.
Uh-huh.
So,
yes.
And go back.
Yeah, and you, and you'll, pardon?
It pulled out of the water.
Okay. Okay, that's a real question. And the thing is, there's no single answer to that question, Scott. It really is a case-by-case situation. It depends a lot on the part of the country you're in, or, you know, the part of the culture you're in. I found here in Colorado Springs that with the people that we're ministering to, who have never given church a thought, we do not stress it at all. We don't talk about it. But we teach them the gospel, they come to Christ, they begin to undergo transformation, and we find out that they've picked out a church and they're going. And that's fine, because it has not come from us. The trick, though, is to keep those people focused on their network of people, and we tell them that up front. Look, if you're a part of this particular body, be careful what you accept, because your real calling is this network of people that you've spent a lifetime building. And so we train them in that. And because I just feel like that's one of the fundamental functions of the church that is most neglected. And so, you know, let's put a little weight on that side, for crying out loud, because so much weight is put on the other. Yes? Well, you know, no, they don't. And it's because of the manner in which you handle that. See, if you handle it like, well, you know, almost all of us now are in the family, but we have this one brother who, let's pray for him. He begins to feel the pressure. But if you accept him, he's okay that way. Just leave him there. I mean, he'll come around. And I think so much of it is our attitude. And someone put down in some note that I read the problem of the being decision-oriented. That is so, we're so steeped in that, that we've got to get that scalp on our belt, otherwise we're just not satisfied. But when we realize, like Mark 4, whether we go to bed, it brings the fruit, we don't know how. Just let it happen. And where that environment is there, where we're laid back about decision time, they'll be comfortable and have the room to make a genuine decision. And I'll tell you something. When you have that attitude, eventually you're going to see a lot of people come to Christ, and you'll almost never see a person make a decision who will not go on to maturity. It's this, back up and dump the truck type of evangelism, which will result in a lot of decisions and almost no disciples. But if you approach your evangelism the way we're talking about here, virtually every person that you get involved with will come to Christ and go on to maturity. That's what will happen. Okay, any other question? I saw a hand. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm a little bit gun-shy about praying with non-Christians because that's weird stuff for a non-Christian that's never been around it. We try to keep it a secular environment, or not a secular environment, but a non-religious environment. So we don't sing songs or anything like that. But what I find is that often the non-Christians really want to pray. And when they do, we do, and there are some very powerful prayer times, as long as you really keep it real, you know, your prayer. So, yeah, even with non-Christians, and then, you know, sometimes they'll pray, and it sounds pretty funny, but they'll pray. Yeah. Yes. Well, the thing that resolves the problem is this. If you let people become an audience rather than a participant, then you're really in trouble. But from day one, if every person has to bring what he's able to do to the party, then you are going to have, everybody is going to develop, and you're going to have the leadership emerging that you need. In fact, something like this really is a factory for leadership, because every person is being taxed to do what he's able to do. And it's amazing how people emerge. Like, I have a next-door neighbor that, you know, I was the first one to show him that there are two testaments in the Bible, and he knows more about the Bible than you can imagine now, and he's a lot better teacher than I am. And so I'm perfectly comfortable being away with him participating with me. And so we develop people who can assume all of these functions. In fact, if you divide down here, this is kind of a cell division, and if you don't have a nucleus in that cell, that's just a bit of protoplasm and it's going to die. And so you have to think in terms of are there people who will kind of keep it together? Is there a person who can guide the discussion in the scriptures? And if there you have that, then you have a viable group. And so it's by distributing the responsibility that you're able to survive it. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question about prayer?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Sit around somebody's home and study the Bible is a pretty interesting thing to do. It's great.
Yeah. Well, and I would say don't force that. But it's interesting. In our study a couple nights ago, we got to talking about prayer because, you know, as you go through any particular book, you come across the subject of prayer. I mean, it's in most of the books of the Bible. And so that kind of prompts a discussion on prayer, doesn't it? And so I told about this friend of mine who, you know, was in college. And you remember who this is, Ed. But he was trying to figure out how to, you know, make Christ real in his life. And he told me this thing, and it was really neat, and I tried it, where he says, I just keep forgetting that Christ is with me. And so when I get in my car, he was at the University of Minnesota, I get in my car, instead of putting my books in the seat, I put them in the back so that Christ can ride along with me. So I'm driving along and I'm talking to him. And he said, then I walk down the street. Instead of walking down the middle of the sidewalk, I move over so that Christ can walk alongside of me. And so and then he says, we talk. And so it might look a little weird, but it helped him envision the presence of Christ. And so I just described it in those terms. And I said, now that's what prayer is. Well, that's something that they can relate to. It takes the mystery out of it, and it moves them into the experience of prayer. So those kinds of things. Okay, our time is up. I'll take...